With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's minor league podcast. I am Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos, Ken Laffin, and Thomas Anderson. How's everyone doing this week?
Pretty good.
All right. Baseball is back in some form.
Yeah, I forgot how boring spring training was.
You're telling me you're not excited for insert bad minor league signing that will somehow make the major league bench playing in spring training?
Like halfway through the first game, I was like, oh, that's why I'm like, whatever about spring. It was exciting at first.
It's just nice to see familiar faces.
Oh, exactly. That's the best part.
All right, so for promote extend trade this week, in 1942, the Battle of Los Angeles took place. In the middle of the night, the defense force in Los Angeles started shooting 50 caliber machine guns and anti-aircraft shells into the air and all that craziness until the all clear sign was given the next morning. And there was no actual threat to Los Angeles. The Navy officially blamed it on war nerves. A lot of people say it was a cover up and that there was a threat and that the Japanese were approaching, or that it was UFOs, or whatever the case. But the Battle of Los Angeles, as a term, has been used for a bunch of different things. So what are we going to promote, extend, or trade here? First, we have Rage Against the Machine's album, Battle of Los Angeles. Next, we have the annual wrestling competition from Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, the Battle of Los Angeles. And then we have another name for the freeway series between the Angels and the Dodgers, which doesn't have the same ring as the subway series, but Battle of Los Angeles.
Any game with Mike Trout gets an extend from me.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of like star power between those two teams. So,
and I don't watch wrestling, so I'm trading that one, which I guess leaves me promoting an album I have no strong feelings about.
No strong feelings.
I belong on Instagram. I'm promoting albums. Hooray.
I think I'm trading that rivalry just because it's like a fake rivalry. Like, I don't think they actually like care about each other all too much. Maybe the Angels do, but I don't think they care about the Angels.
See, I mean, even if it's not a real rivalry, whatever that means, that the both those teams just have so many fun players.
Oh, sure. That's fair. The games will be fun, no matter what.
How many top five players in baseball would be playing in that game?
Well, two for sure, and then you're debating whether Bellinger is top five or not.
Yeah.
Bellinger's top 10 for sure.
And that doesn't even count Otani, because I'm assuming you're talking about...
Or Rendon.
Yeah, it's one of Rendon or...
Yeah, I don't think Rendon's top five.
Yeah.
I think there might be an argument for Bellinger, but I don't think so either. Who are the top five players in baseball? Trout, Betts, Lindor, and...
We're talking just position players?
I was going to ask, is DeGrom Scherzer, but are they both in the top five?
I think DeGrom might be. Hell, maybe it is Bellinger. Yelich.
Probably over Bellinger.
Yep.
Well, how many top 10 players in baseball?
Well, four. I don't think Kershaw's top 10 anymore.
No, he's probably top 20, which begs the question, how many top 20 players are
there? Well, now we're going to have to argue about Max Muncy, because I firmly believe Muncy is like a top 15 player in baseball, and just no one notices. Muncy is a goddamn monster.
He's very good.
One of my friends was like, he kind of knows baseball, but like isn't super into it, was like, why did they extend Muncy? And I'm like, oh, he's so good, that's why they extend
Because he's a little god. The dude just rakes. Point is, really good teams. And then Trout will represent the Blake Trout. We also haven't mentioned Simmons. I just realized.
Yeah.
Belongs somewhere in that top, maybe not top 20, but like at least adjacent to the conversation.
Well, that has kind of changed my mind, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, not really. I'm still trading it, but it's actually not a boring. It's not as boring as it seems at first glance, definitely.
I think it's just because it's not, like, billed that way. Like, we're not going to get the Sunday night baseball of it. Well, because they're both on the West Coast, but, like.
We're just going to watch Red Sox Yankees for the.
Exactly.
3 millionth time.
When the Red Sox are going to, like, suck this year, and the Yankees are going to be one of the best teams in baseball.
Not if all their pitchers keep getting injured.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. They're really good.
They'll be regular season really good, at least.
They'll hit.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, before we start things off this week, I just want to revisit one of the topics that we talked about last week, the MLB 20 rosters. Actually, the day after our show, J.J. Cooper from Baseball America, he did some digging, and they released an article. And apparently, when minor league players sign the player's uniform contract, they forfeit their rights to be compensated for their likenesses being used.
Yeah.
So specifically it says, quote, the player's name, voice, signature, biographical information, and likeness shall belong to the club, and they may be used, reproduced, sold, licensed, or otherwise disseminated or published by the club or its licensees, assignees, and or other designees, directly or indirectly in any medium whatsoever, for any purpose, including, but not limited to, broadcast, in print, on trading cards, posters, and other merchandise of any kind, in electronics, audio, in video, or in connection with any media, in any manner and at any time.
If you check the like tiny text there, it says, or Eldritch rituals, you know, just really covering every basis possible here.
Yeah.
Wait, in any medium?
In any medium.
At any time.
At any time. Okay. In any manner.
Crazy.
So this isn't a new provision, right?
No.
It's just, like, getting brought up because of their likenesses being in the show.
Yeah, so. Right. Well, it's this definitely got thrown in at a time when it didn't matter. And MLB's like, oh, yeah, we have these now. Very interesting.
And, you know, Sony did their research and was like, oh, we don't have to pay them. So we definitely
can't. Yeah, so once again, minor league is getting screwed. What's new?
Sky is still blue.
Mm-hmm. But I guess that brings us to this week's topic, which is the first annual Way Too Early Draft Preview.
Right.
Yep. Hopefully this podcast goes on for years and years, so we can have more than one annual Way Too Early Draft Preview. But I actually thought this was the second, and that the first one was on a segment from the old Amazing Avenue Audio, but I went back into the archives and I checked all the way to like 2017 and I couldn't find anything. which is weird because I randomly remember talking about Seth Beer, who was in no way, shape, or form ever tied to the Mets, but whatever.
Who wasn't talking about a guy named Seth Beer?
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of surprising that he wasn't tied to the Mets in retrospect? That feels like a very Mets pick.
Yeah.
Unathletic,
one-dimensional.
College, yeah.
I still kind of think he's good.
he might be.
He might just be an absurdly good hitter.
Yeah, like he might just hit his way through to majors.
But we'll see. Only time will tell.
I feel like, well, he's definitely going to make the majors. Yes. Yeah, well, he does.
Who's starting for the Diamondbacks at first base? Christian Walker?
Yes.
I think. Nailed it. Yeah,
I only remember that because of fantasy last year.
Yep.
He was like a big name for a bit.
Yep. Yeah, because he came up and hit for a month and then was like, oh, wait, you're not actually good. Yeah, I think Beer gets some at-bats this season.
The college season just started. High school baseball is going to start in a little bit. So technically draft season has started, I guess. But, you know, still months away. There's going to be a huge amount of variance in all those lists that MLB.com, Baseball America, you know, the two powerhouses there that they put out. And then the kind of secondary college websites and high school websites and all that kind of stuff. Guys are going to drop in rankings. Guys are going to shoot up. You know, nothing is really static except for the first couple of picks, like maybe 1 through 4 or so. And then you kind of have a vague consensus about big chunks of guys, you know, grouping them into tiers. So-and-so is like a back end of the first round guy. So-and-so is a kind of really talented, but he's a long shot to actually signed, so he's gonna drop and things like that. So where the Mets pick this year, 19, it's kind of a weird place to be in, and I think we say that every single year.
That's because they somehow always manage to be just bad enough to be like the very end of a tier in the draft.
Yeah.
Yep. All the top tier guys.
It's the Mets way.
Yeah. Well, the top tier guys are going to be gone. Every so often, there's some extenuating circumstances where those top tier guys kind of do drop, but who knows. So all of the guys that are going to be available are probably going to be guys with, like, flaws. The Mets picked at 19 a few years ago in 2016, and they picked Justin Dunn. And obviously, every draft class is different, but he's a pretty good example of what I mean when I say a guy is flawed. Obviously, he made his MLB draft his MLB debut already, so that's good. You know, obviously, there was plenty of talent in him, but there were concerns, mainly being his workload, which is very limited, given the fact that he was a reliever for most of his college career, and then the fact that his mechanics are pretty high effort, which caused kind of shaky command, and he was really just a two-pitch fastball slider guy. So there was stuff to like, but there were blemishes. And obviously, if that wasn't the case, he would have been picked higher than 19. So the guys that will be available when the Mets pick, there's going to be blemishes. But, you know, that is kind of the case with every player. The goal of a amateur scouting department is to identify the guys with the talent. And then the guys with the talent, you know, they go into the system and the system takes the guy and maximizes his talents and minimizes his flaws. So the Mets have a so-so record in that regard. So let's cross our fingers.
So-so is generous.
Yeah. So who would like to talk about that guy first? The Mets' first round pick. Anyone want to volunteer, or should I just go?
Lead on, fearless leader.
All right. Alrighty. So with the first pick, I would like to see the Mets go after a guy named CJ Van Eyck. And if the name rings a bell for anybody, it is because the Mets drafted him in the 19th round in the 2017 draft. He's one of those long shot picks, you know, that teams make. He had a commitment to FSU, Florida State, which is a really big baseball school. And he also had some medical problems that spring. There was some arm soreness. So it was pretty much a guarantee that he wasn't going to sign. But, you know, you always go for those long shots because you never know. Obviously, he went to college. And in his freshman year, he pitched mainly out of the bullpen, got a couple of starts. But pretty good line all in all. 286 ERA in 56 and two-thirds of an inning. Allowed 42 hits, walked 30, struck out 71. And then last season, he was moved into the weekend rotation. And he was a pretty big reason why the Seminoles went deep into the College World Series. He had a 380 ERA in 94 and two-thirds total innings, which is, you know, okay. Not phenomenal, but it's pretty good. He allowed 82 hits, he walked 39, and he struck out 120. So that's a good number there. Van Eyck, like I said earlier, you know, he's a guy that's going to have some flaws. Number one, he's not the biggest guy. He's 6'1", 200 pounds. It's not bad, but, you know, a couple of more inches would be nice. You want your starting pitchers to be real big, athletic, hulking guys. Number two, he hasn't been particularly efficient. He's averaged about 5 innings of work and 95 pitches per outing. Part of that's on him because the control isn't exactly pinpoint. But part of that is also because his pitches have a lot of movement. So his fastball, it sits in low mid-90s, tops out about 96, and there's a lot of arm side life late. So it's really good. That's a lot of where a lot of those strikeouts come from. It's above average velocity, above average movement, definitely an above average pitch. And then he complements that with a really, really good curveball and then an okay changeup, maybe a little bit more than just okay. The curveball's a big 12-6 breaker, sits in the high 70s, has really sharp late break. And then the changeup, it sits in the high 70s, and it doesn't have too much fade, but he does throw with the same arm speed as his fastball, so he gets deception in that regard. And it's a pitch that, you know, it's not terrible. It's definitely workable right now, and hopefully it never takes any steps back, and he can just keep improving on it. And basically, I'm interested in him because I think that the team is lacking it's lacking a lot of things, obviously, but one of them, I think, is high-end pitching. In the top 25, we really don't have that much high-end pitching. The most notable guys, I guess, are Matthew Allen, Joshua Wolf, and Junior Santos, and those guys are still, you know, teenagers. You know, in the upper minors, there's Thomas Zupucki, who really knows what's going to go on there. David Peterson, Tony DeBrell, Harrell, you know, they don't really kind of have front of the rotation upside, whereas Van Eyck does. So I think also the Mets have been very successful at developing pitchers of his kind of mold. So I think that he could probably get the most out of his stuff in the Mets' system than elsewhere.
That's fair.
Yeah.
We're looking at the spread on him from different sources. Like MLB has him going 20th and Fangraphs has him 5th. It's kind of...
Yeah, a lot, I think, is dependent on, well, obviously, how he does this year. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, his first year was kind of a wash. He was in the bullpen for most of it. And he kind of was, you know, like I said, pretty good, but not great last season. So depending, you know, the stuff is there. He could be great. So if it, you know, all shows up, then he'll probably be out of the Mets' range. But if, you know, he's just okay again, then he could definitely be in their target area there.
I think we're doing this very early. I feel like we're going to close every one of these segments with depending on how things go this year.
Of course.
These guys are going to be swinging all over the place.
That's the big asterisk on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Should be the episode title.
Big asterisks?
The big asterisk.
I think that could cover I think that's a good description for all of minor league baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, if no one minds, I'll hop in here with my guy then, because I think it segues nicely on that note of college pitchers being somewhat fungible right now. So my guy, similar to you, Steve, I had the same thought where the system doesn't have a lot of pitching, and definitely doesn't have a lot of pitching in the high minors. And while the major league team definitely is in a mode where it needs reinforcement sooner rather than later, I feel like they're at a point towards the tail end of a contention cycle where, as long as you're not totally blowing up the roster and resetting, you should be trying to get talent that comes up pretty quickly. So to that end, I went with a pick that's probably going to be pretty ironic given how much I rail against Peterson and Anthony Kay. But left-hand pitcher Reed Detmers, he's from Louisville, the junior. So probably like the tier behind Van Eyck, depending on how things work out this year, but a lot of the same things could be said. Really good high school numbers, bad freshman year, breakout sophomore year. He was the ace of Louisville staff as a sophomore, 18 starts, 113 innings, 167 strikeouts, which is obviously great, though you're reading into college stats at that point, ACC pitcher of the year. Now, the knock on him as a high schooler was that his fastball wasn't super great, his stuff wasn't super great, and that's still definitely true. Fastball is in the low 90s with some arm side run, but it's nothing super special. He throws a nice curve that has high spin rate, which is interesting, and he seems to have a real feel for it, but not the kind of stuff that fits the top of the rotation archetype. And he's physically maxed at 6'2", 210. But a guy who should move pretty fast. A guy who, unlike Anthony Kay, hasn't been ridden into the ground in college. And I don't think Louisville is typically a program that does that, unlike UConn. So that makes me less hesitant to drop this kind of pitcher and hope they move, or to draft this kind of pitcher and hope they move fast. It'll be interesting to see if he can continue his gains from sophomore year. And then depending on how well that goes, if he's even on the board still when the Mets get a chance.
Yeah, a thing to note, obviously, is that you never want to draft based on, you know, team need. That kind of stuff is short-sighted. But, like, a guy like Van Eyck or a guy like Detmers, these are guys that are generally considered to be in, like, that second half, second tier of the first round, whatever you want to call it. So they fill a need, and they're, like, the best guys, you know, available at the same time.
There's a very good chance that either one of them would be the best player available when the Mets pick.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. To be clear, you should always go best player available with baseball drafts. But I do think there's, like, as a kind of, when you're working on the Fudge factor, you can start thinking about need, at least on the pitching side, I think. If you draft for need on the hitting side, you're just, like, wasting your time because half the time guys are going to change positions on you and not wind up where you wanted them in the first place. But pitching is just kind of pitching.
Yep, there's always a need. You can always adjust the guy's role based on how he's doing, what you and what the team needs from him. So
right. You shouldn't draft a catcher because, well, catcher's a whole other issue. You shouldn't draft a center fielder because you need a center fielder, right? But if you need upper minors pitching, that's easier to target directly.
Yeah.
That said, if a guy like, I don't know, who's the top prep player this year? Jordan Walker or something? If someone like that's still on the board, you say, all right, screw the pitching. I'm getting the best player I can.
Yeah, that's something to note is that a lot of, you know, draft people have mentioned that this year's draft class, it is deep in terms of college pitching, but it's not very, very high upside. It is kind of lacking in college hitting, and there are a lot of pretty good high schoolers available. Obviously, all this, you know, is way too early, but yes, of course. Speaking of prep bats,
my pick is a prep bat.
There
so,
we go.
Pete Crow Armstrong is my pick. He's been someone who's been around the circuit for a while, like, he's played in a bunch of the showcase games, and he played for the U.S. baseball as like a youth level, on the youth level, I mean. So the things that stand out about him is his defense is very good. He's a center fielder. Right now, he's an outfielder. His defense, as of right now, is very good, and he's very fast, and he has a good arm. So it's one of those things that, like, it gives him a floor, even though he's a prep bat. It gives him a pretty high floor for moving up the system and moving up rather quickly as long as his hitting follows suit. And I think that's one of the things that I found interesting with him is that, like, I feel like you don't really find prep players who have solid-ish floors because they're all so young. But if someone could play defense and could play defense at a high level, then you could build around that, and then it's just an easy step up from there. He's hit pretty well. Obviously, I mean, he wouldn't be a prep bat in the first round if he didn't hit very well wherever he was. He has a nice, compact stance, good hands. He's 6 foot, 175, so he has a chance to fill out and get more weight on him without really losing any of that speed and that defense. And he's one of those people that, like, the Mets do need pitching, but I think if someone like this with that interesting blend of talent, someone who has shown that he could hit and also has that speed and defense combination, you kind of have to take a swing at that just because getting that level of talent in the system is something that they don't have. He is, I think, committed to Vanderbilt, that's going to be a problem. But you could throw money at that situation like most teams do at that point, especially in the first round. And if you're not trying to pull a Matthew Allen thing in the third, you could spend a little more money in the first. But yeah, that's basically it. He's someone who caught my eye because of that interesting combination. And he's, again, someone who could shoot up the draft boards because it's like February. But yeah, he's one of those dudes that's definitely interesting to me.
I don't think I go 80 on the name. 70 grade name.
Oh, the name is incredible.
70. There are definitely better names, but that's quite good.
He is a guy that could conceivably be, you know, best case scenario, a 5-tool player, which is obviously good. You know, the hit tool is pretty good. The arm, the defense, the speed, everything is good. The power is a little questionable, yeah. but you know, like you said, he is 6'1", 175. So he could pull McNeil and put on like 20, 30 pounds and still be a very athletic 6'1", 200 pounds, which, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, you take that easily. And I mean, even if the power doesn't fill out, like, that's still a valuable player.
That's absolutely.
Like Jake Mangum, but actually good.
Exactly.
If Jake Mangum could hit.
Yeah. What if Jake Mangum was 5 years younger and could hit?
Well, he had no problem hitting college pitching, but yeah.
I mean,
minor league pitching, professional pitching, yes, a very different beast.
Let me just shove my bat in the zone and let it ting off into left field. Ping. I hate that sound.
Well, Ken, can your pick hit?
Yeah, I think so. My pick was Heston Kjerstad, an outfielder out of Arkansas. He was originally drafted in the 36th round of the 2017 draft by the Mariners out of Texas. And really all he's done in his 2 years at Arkansas was like win games and hit. He hit 332, 419, 553 with 14 dingers as a freshman. And 329, 404, 574 with, I think, his school record, 16 homers as a sophomore. So his big thing is power. He, you know, is a very tall kid, very long levers, and how should I put this?
He hits dingers.
Yeah, his name is Heston, and he likes to hit dingers. I watched him play in Arkansas's first game of the year a couple days ago, and his, I think, second at bat of the game, he pulled like a 93 mile an hour fastball, like up in the zone, pulled it out to right field, and then two at bats later, he went down and got a curveball off a lefty and just kind of poked it out the other way to left.
Nice.
So it's power line to line, and, you know, a lot of people are worried about he strikes out a fair bit, 17.5% as a freshman and 21.5% as a sophomore, which, you know, it's typically not ideal, especially amongst college, you know, polished college hitters, but I think he's going to deceive people with, his ability to hit for average. I think he's really underrated in that regard because there's a good amount of barrel control there. So I'm very bullish on him.
Are you worried about the defensive home at all?
I mean, my reputation on this podcast is that I typically don't worry about such things. I think he could play a good enough left field, and I think he's going to hit enough where who cares.
Okay.
Like, I like the swing. There's a little bit of noise in the hands, but he seems to have a feel for keeping everything on time and everything. And, it's a pretty smooth, like, quick bat, like, he's got very good bat speed, and the bat path is not very long for the amount of movement that he has, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, if you can hit, then it doesn't really matter what your defense is.
Yep.
As long as you are hitting.
I also think there's no way he makes it to 20, where the Mets pick. I think he's similar to Hunter Bishop was last year, but with like a track record of being good. I think he's going to hit like 25 dingers this year and end up in the top 10.
So you think he's going to like JJ Bladé this basically?
Oh yeah, yeah, but he already has a track record of hitting for power.
That's fair.
So.
Well,
I think he's very, very good.
For the Mets' sake, let's cross our fingers there.
Yes. He could also end up going the way of Casey Meisner and struggling once SEC play starts.
It's true.
So.
Well, I wonder if he gets, I mean, cause Beer just raked, granted he's nowhere near, like, even if you think his home is first base, he's nowhere near that unathletic. Like, Beer might not even be able to play first base, so. Maybe like defensive concerns keep him on the board for the Mets as well, if he hits this year.
Yep, entirely possible.
And at 19, like,
yeah, you take that risk.
You take the risk there. You don't take it at 10, but you take it at 19.
Let's clarify. You take that risk for a special bat. You don't take that risk for like Will Craig.
Yeah.
Luckily, the Mets didn't.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
All right, let's take a look at the second round now. We'll do a little, not as much depth here because obviously it's hard enough to kind of project who might go in the first round at 19, let alone who might go at the second round at, you know, 53. But one guy that would be really cool if he was still available that the Mets could snag for me would be, Jace Borofin. He's an outfielder from Westmore High School in Oklahoma, and he has a commitment to the University of Oklahoma, but he should be signable. And he's a big, solid 6'2", 200-pound outfielder, plenty of power from the left side of the plate. It's a pretty smooth swing, not too much effort, a lot of hard contact. And right now it's been mostly gap power, but he registers high exit velocities, and the ball has a lot of backspin, so those are signs that point to the more power in the future. And like we were just talking about, his upside, his main selling point is the power, but he is an okay outfielder. He's about average speed and a good arm, plus arm maybe even. and okay instincts. So for the time being, he can play any of the three outfield positions, but he's probably going to be a corner guy in the future. But that would be a fun guy to see the second round. Absolutely. Lucas, who would you like to see?
Again, very fungible spot. I went with a prep arm, and I'll say, like, I don't really know how to evaluate prep arms from just using the internet, so I'll assume the Mets pick a good one, but I went with Nick Griffin. that's a generous assumption, I know. He's a lefty from Arkansas, Mount Castle High School. He has a commitment to Arkansas, which I imagine is not it's probably not the strongest commitment, right? Like, it's not like it's Vanderbilt or Louisville or one of those blue-collar or blue-chip programs. Whatever the phrasing is there.
Brandon Nimmo broke his commitment to Arkansas. This kid might, too.
yeah, absolutely. Then again, who knows? He's pretty rake thin, which I find encouraging. Like, there's definitely room for growth there at 6'4", 180. He's like 5 inches taller than me and weighs the same. Plenty of room there for frame growth. Smooth delivery, low 90s, three-quarter arm slot. Doesn't repeat it always, which, I mean, he's a high school pitcher, shocking. Apparently, he has a real feel for a curveball, which is what attracted my interest. And, of course, since it's a prep arm, he might have had a real feel for a curveball in two starts that some random guy had, and he's never going to have that feel again for the rest of, like, the spring. So, who knows? But curveball, that's good. The other thing that I found interesting is that he's currently a two-way player, probably not a real two-way prospect, but like a legitimate athlete, like a real nice 60-yard dash time, a good 10-yard split. Like, the dude is a real legitimately good outfielder, at least on the grass, and can hit a little bit right now. So there's theoretically a fallback to that, and if nothing else, I think just having that athleticism makes you should make you a better pitcher. Like, most of the best pitchers are good athletes, with the exception of, like, Bartolo Colon or
excuse me. He's athletic in his own way.
Okay. All right. However we want to describe him. I think generally I'm open to more risk in the second, especially since, like, most of the top end talent is gone. There's an argument to make that the Mets are late enough in the first that you should just be kind of throwing caution to the wind. But definitely in the second round, like, go for broke.
Yep. Agreed.
For sure.
All right, Thomas, who do you got?
Ironically, I also took a two-way player who is a prep player.
It's cool. It'd be cool.
It is cool. I chose Mason Wynn, he's from Texas. He's much shorter than Lucas's pick. He's 5'11", 180. Mm-hmm. But he is like a legit two-way prospect, according to Baseball America. He throws hard. He's been clocked at 97, 98, and he's also a shortstop. So it's one of those things that I'm sure, like, when you're throwing 97, 98, you're a two-way prospect no matter what in high school, because the rest of the kids can't hit that probably. But there's, like, he apparently has feels for secondary pitches. Like, it's not that he's just out there throwing gas by everyone and not doing anything else. He has a curveball and he has a changeup. Like, his changeup is his third pitch, but, like, his curveball is his main secondary. And if the changeup comes along, there'll be a real starter there. But either way, like Lucas said, getting a kid who could play two positions and just that influx of talent and athleticism is so interesting. And when you're picking in the second round, like, if someone like that is there, it's almost a no-brainer to just take that. And you might get, even if it's not a two-way player and you get one of the two, then it's still a win. So that's how I looked at it. He has a commitment to Arkansas as well. So Arkansas is just...
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, just lapping up the two-way players all over the country, apparently. But
I wonder how the new roster rules might make these guys on the fringes of your roster that you can that can relieve or can throw a couple innings while also being a serviceable bat. I wonder if that's going to have, like, additional utility as people figure out how to maximize the new roster rules. So,
it makes sense too.
Yeah, not that that should affect the draft thought process at all, but just an idea for down the line.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe a two-way player doesn't get kicked off one position as quick or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, in Japan, it's something that happens a lot is you'll have the pitcher, you know, I mean, it does happen occasionally in the majors. Not any time recently that I could think, really, but, you know, you send the pitcher into the outfield for, you know, an inning, a matchup, whatever the case, and then you switch him back when it becomes advantageous.
I was going to say Michael Lorenzen, but he's like a real two-way player.
Yeah, but guys, and then of course Otani now, but, you know, guys with the ability to pitch and just kind of either excel or wing it at an actual position, you know, that's makes juggling the lineup a lot easier for a manager, definitely.
I'm still holding out hope that we see JD Davis, the pitcher, at some point.
I mean, he's got to be the number one position player to pitch.
Is JD Davis like the new Spaceball saying? JD Davis, the hitter. JD Davis, the third baseman. JD Davis, starting left fielder. JD Davis, reliever.
Listen, I just want to see JD Davis hit okay again. And
I mean, he looked better at third on February 23rd.
Yes, yes. Meaningful. Meaningful data with good sample size, yes.
He made like three nice plays today or something like that.
He didn't look like a corpse being dragged around on puppet strings at third base, which objective improvement.
Oh no.
He turned a double play and didn't lollipop the ball to second. So, progress.
Based on that one look in February, he clearly now has a feel for third.
Kick McNeil back to left.
He's in the best shape of his life.
Oh no.
Ken, is your guy in the best shape of his life?
Maybe. He's 17.
So no.
Blaze Jordan, a first baseman from Mississippi. It's a guy who had a lot of hype around him, as one of the best prospects in the 2021 draft. But for some reason, reclassified to get into the draft this year, a year earlier than expected as a 17-year-old. And, you know, basically the entire reason I'm picking him here is because he's very, very young and has a reputation.
Really? Yeah, is that it?
I mean, that's more or less it, yes.
So you're trying to tell me that you did not pick him because his name is Blaze Jordan.
His name is Blaze Jordan, which is a pretty fantastic name. One that I would maybe get a shirt of someday.
I hope he puts Blaze on the back of it.
I would. If he makes it to a point where he can do Players Weekend, that's 100% what he should do.
I was talking to a friend who's not as tuned into the draft as we are, and he still thought Blaze Jordan was going to go like one overall.
There's like, every few years, there's like one of these high school kids that gets hyped as, you know, the next Bryce Harper or whatever. Bryce Harper being like the original. But yeah, there are some things to like with Blaze Jordan. He, has extremely well developed raw power. He's won a bunch of like national showcase home run derbies. There are stories of him hitting 500-foot home runs as like a 13-year-old. So, you know, big, big-time power, which anybody who's been listening to me talk on this podcast for a while knows is something that I am a sucker for.
I'm pretty sure Ken's ideal team is like 9 first basemen. Just
I love first basemen.
Rolling around the field attempting to play defense.
He has that Adam Dunn at every position team.
Oh, no.
The on-base percentage would be so high.
We'll have to have Dave try to simulate that one.
Oh, God.
Just OBP and dingers and no defense.
Who has MLB The Show? Someone set this up and see how many
games.
Yeah,
no, I'll ping Dave later. That seems like something he'd be good at. But yeah, the big question with Blaze Jordan is nobody's sure if he'll be able to hit for average. In the second round, I, you know, am willing to roll the dice in the hopes that you get a potential legitimate power bat at some point down the line. So, something to note though, I'm not sure how far over slot I would go to sign him. There's a decent amount of risk here. So if he's looking to, you know, get a bonus of like first round money, I don't think I would do that.
Do you think he's going to take a big bonus?
So that's the thing is like, I don't know why
I think he probably really wants to go pro if he reclassified to, you know, go pro a year earlier, despite, you know, potentially being a top prospect in one draft class and probably being much lower, in the earlier draft class. That being said, like, if he doesn't go in the top three rounds, I feel like he could just go, he's going to go to Mississippi State. That's a very good program that gets a lot of people drafted. And, you know, it's typically easier for an SEC first baseman to go in the first few rounds than, you know, a 17-year-old lottery ticket.
See, I totally agree with that latter take, if not for the reclassification. It just kind of...
And so, like, I think he might not take a ton of money. But that's something I wanted to bring up. It's like, I'm not going to, you know, Matt Allen my draft for him.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I might give him Josh Wolf money.
Sure.
Yeah. I think he takes that. He might just be a guy, though. He might just be a guy who's best served going to college, I think.
And like getting a little more refined.
Yeah, because, like, let's see. The average questions come from, like, the showcase circuit, and that's, like, such a noisy environment. Like, if he goes to the SEC and plays reasonably well, you know, there's potential that he could end up a first-round, you know, player.
Yeah, I don't know if he'd ever, like, totally tank his value. I don't know how – his value, I guess, if he goes to the SEC and it's just himself. Like, it's not like –
Yeah, it's just, like, a good performer. He'll still get drafted.
Yeah, it's not like he's going to fall off the face of the
draft. He probably wouldn't get, you know, second-round money, but
– I mean, how often do first basemen go in the first round, honestly? Like
– I mean, Seth Beer was
– Seth Beer was, like, pick 30, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, that's better than pick
53. Sure. Well, I mean, but before
it's probably Vaughn, $1 million or so.
Before Vaughn, when was the last time like an actual for sure first baseman went in the top 15?
Top 15?
Yeah. All right. I feel like I don't know what he gains by going to college. Honestly.
Does Dom Smith count because he got picked 11th?
Oh, of course it's the Mets.
Smith got taken 11th.
God damn it.
They get taken pretty frequently in, like, the 20 to 40 range.
That's fair. Of course it's the Mets.
Like, Alonzo was what, like, the 4th or 5th first baseman taken? Pavin Smith was taken in that general area, I think.
He has a few guys before him.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he's kind of interesting, and in the second round at that age with that kind of power, I think that's a pretty good lottery ticket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just weird. Very weird.
All right. Well, we've gone over the first round and the second round, but the Mets will have one more selection. They're going to get a pick at 73, and we can thank Zach Wheeler for that because it's going to be a compensation pick for losing him. And very similar to our second round discussion just now, it's a fool's errand, I guess, to, you know, guess who's going to be available. But we're fools.
Yes, and, we're Mets fans.
Exactly. So at 73, a cool guy that I'd like to see get picked would be Casey Schmidt, who plays at San Diego State. And I guess this is a completely unintentional theme here, but he generally plays third base. But over his first two seasons, he's accrued 75 innings out of the bullpen, and he has 17 saves. So he is also another two-way player. It's kind of interesting, I guess, that we all kind of had the same thought pattern here without actually consulting each other or talking about it. We should become GMs.
Only two-way players.
Yes.
Why don't we build the whole roster out of two-way players?
So first we're going to trade, like, literally the entire farm system for Ohtani because he's the best two-way player, and then we'll figure it out from there.
I mean...
That sounds like a plan.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a bad plan.
We need Ohtani, McKay, Lorenzen. I'm out of names.
I just want to go on record and say that I've only chosen one-way players. And not just one-way players.
You've chosen like
half-dimensional one-way
halfway players. Defense? Nah. Don't need to play defense when you're just hitting dingers.
Hit mash taters, man.
Yeah.
Boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew.
With Schmidt, the pitching is a little bit more than just a novelty. He's, you know, kind of decent at it. He's got a low 90s fastball and an average splitter. And he's kind of been like the fireman for the Aztecs bullpen. But if you're going to draft him, obviously you draft him because you like the bat. And he is a power of a hit guy, but he does make solid contact. So, you know, the batting average might not be anything too special. You know, but at the same time, it's not like he's going to project to be a 200 hit or nothing like that. And he does have a pretty decent eye, so that should buoy his OBP. And something that I do like is that the bat did show up in the Cape over this past summer, and he hit 8 home runs with a wood bat, so that's always encouraging. A lot of guys, you know, they'll have college power, and then it'll disappear. You know, David Thompson comes to mind. And defensively, he's a pretty good third baseman, obviously because he has, you know, a low 90s fastball. He has a plus arm. He's pretty adept at throwing at all different angles like third basemen have to. So his throws are accurate. Range is about average. Reactions are above average. So he should be able to handle the hot corner. No problems. And if the bat develops, you know, you don't need your third baseman to be hitting, you know, 300 or nothing like that. It'd be optimal, I mean, obviously, but not necessary. Who do you got for the Zach Wheeler replacement?
I forgot. So mine is, remember how I said don't draft a catcher because you need a catcher? Yeah, well, I went with a catcher here. This is Dylan Dingler. He's a junior from Ohio State. Big for a catcher at 6'3", 210, but apparently his defense is shockingly good, even though he just swapped to catching from center field last season. So
that's a big change.
Yeah, and apparently he took to it. Like his arm strength is great, though as we know, that's not the most important part of catching anymore. But anecdotally, and I don't know that we really have framing stats for college, nor would I trust them if we did. But anecdotally, the pitchers like throwing to him. There was definitely a state, he missed some time, and I'll get back to that in a second. And the pitching staff was definitely more stable under him than his replacement, or they preferred throwing to him. And I think there might be some under the radar-ness to him because, he broke his hamate bone on the first game of the season last year. And while he did come back and post an OPS just above 800, that's not spectacular for a college hitter, but hamate injuries linger, wrist injuries linger, hand injuries linger. And I wonder if there's more offensive upside here than people have realized that'll be slept on a bit because he'll have 1 year of production if he hits this year. So I've been really interested to see if his discipline issues or his discipline improvements from last season continue and if the power improves with a healthy offseason or just with a healthy hand this time around.
He is an interesting guy. Just no other fact than, you know, he went from center to catching.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a big dude for a catcher. So it'd be cool if he could – he's a big dude for a catcher that's supposedly good at catching, right? Like – the only big catcher in baseball these days is like Salvador Perez, and he's a pretty terrible catcher. So,
Wilson Ramos,
catcher.
He's a
large
human.
The loosest possible definition of the word catcher.
Does he squat back there and catch them? Yes.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes he doesn't catch them. Sometimes more often than other people.
Sometimes he doesn't catch them, but he's back there.
All that matters.
It's in the name.
Not called the dropper.
So just my final caveat on this is, like, it's really dependent on how he hits this year, because if his offense is, like, capped at how he hit last year, I don't really care. Like, go for something more exciting than a whatever catcher, college catching prospect. But if there's a jump in offense, I think the gamble on, he's actually good and he was just suppressed by the injury last year is worth it in the third round.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, if he does kind of excel at some of the facets of catching, then that's reason alone right there to be drafting him, and then, you know, potential of the bat to get better.
Yeah, especially if he just became a catcher and he's kind of good at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. So yeah. If he has to have some type of innate ability to do it, mm-hmm. whatever that is, you know, it's hard to judge.
There's a lot of, like, defensive catchers who play in the big leagues despite not being able to hit at all. The Mets have employed quite a few of them. Like, all of them.
They're second in catcher. They're going to give, like, 300 at-bats to those catchers this year.
Yeah. So, if he's, like, a good defensive catcher, the bat doesn't need to come around all that much.
Yeah.
That's true.
And if it does, there's serious upside.
There are a couple other catchers in this range from the various boards I was looking at, but he was the interesting one because of the conversion, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, who you got, Thomas?
Okay, so I have another prep arm, because apparently all I do is look at high school prospects, but it was a total accident, too. I just picked three people who were interesting, and then I realized after that I picked three prep people. But this one is Jason Savakool, I think is how you pronounce his last name.
That's the spell name, it.
Savakool. That has to be it.
All right, that might be an 80 grade name.
Right. He's from upstate New York, and the thing that jumped out to me as he's from upstate New York and he flashes three good pitches for someone who plays in a cold weather environment, like, I feel like that's kind of rare to be.
You've convinced me. I'm in.
Right? He throws, like, low 90s. Right now, he's sitting low 90s with his fastball. He's hit 94-ish. He throws a slider, and he also has a circle change that is, he kind of, according to MLB Pipeline, it's kind of like a split-finger changeup type thing. And he uses all three of those pitches, and he's used them pretty effectively as he's pitched. So I think the thing that makes him interesting for me in the third round is he's a high school senior who has three solid pitches, and you could get him into a place where he's now pitching more because he's going from upstate New York to, like, Florida, where he would be playing for if he would be drafted. He has a commitment to Maryland, which I'm sure isn't, like, you could probably convince him out of that. But, yeah, that's basically it. Someone who has three solid pitches at 17, 18 years old is automatically interesting to me.
Yeah, as a cold weather guy, he might be overlooked enough to fall down here.
Yeah, that was my thought. Like, he's just not pitching as much as other people. I mean, Trout was a late first. I'm not saying he's going to be the pitching equivalent of, but Trout was a late first because he was from Jersey and he just played less than everyone else, you know? So, like, I don't know. It's one of those things that in the third round you could swing on that upside and hope.
Yeah, there's some pretty good upside there. So, would be a good pick, I think.
Yeah.
All right, last but not least, Ken, who do you have?
So I went with another person who was familiar to me, Kevin Abel, the right-handed pitcher from Oregon State. So I liked him a lot. I watched a decent amount of Oregon State in 2018, trying to get a feel for, you know, what Adley Rutschman was going to look like. And he was kind of the ace of the staff on the College World Series winning team in 2018, for, you know, not particularly good reasons, but, you know, he posted a 2.88 ERA with 108 Ks against 46 walks in 81 innings. So a little bit higher of a walk rate than you'd prefer from a college pitcher, but a lot of strikeouts, as a freshman in 2018. And, he came back in 2019 after the College World Series campaign and only managed to throw, I think it was 21 innings, before his season ended because he needed Tommy John surgery. So the reason I kind of like Kevin Abel in the third round, despite the health problems, are if the stuff bounces back, and you should get to see it at least once or twice, presumably, before draft day, if the stuff bounces back after Tommy John and he looks pretty good, I think he probably would have gone, you know, much higher than the third round if that hadn't happened and, you know, he just looked like he did as a freshman. So I think there's potential that you'd be getting a pretty good pitcher later than, you know, he would go if not for a pretty big risk factor, but, you know, one I'm willing to roll the dice on. Again, because I really liked him as a freshman. So,
yeah, he is a guy that kind of meshes well with that big amorphous blob of kind of solid but nothing crazy high in the upside department pitchers, yeah. College pitchers, and
two pretty good secondaries.
Yeah, you know, getting good a guy fastball. Like that in the
it's 70s. Like David Peterson's a really good value in the third round.
Yeah, I wanted to say that he as soon as you said Oregon, I said, oh, David Peterson, I have bad memories. Obviously, this is Oregon State as opposed to the University of Oregon, but still.
I mean, I'm just glad Ken didn't pick another first baseman.
Hey, Kerstad is not a first baseman yet. That day may never come.
Well, if he's drafted by the Mets, hopefully that day never comes.
And if he's drafted by the Mets, he'll never be a first baseman. They'll put him in left field forever.
That is a good point also. So, yeah. All right, well, does anyone have any last words for the week? Ken, I think you might have one, Ken.
Can we just pronounce Savakul like Gabagool? If we do any recurring of this segment.
I mean,
no offense to him, I just think it would be funny.
Tune in 3 months when we all have like literally the opposite take on these players and bash the Mets for selecting them. You know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we'll be definitely after the draft, we'll have to go back and look at this one and obviously, in the second annual Way Too Early draft special, we'll laugh at ourselves for all these horrible takes.
Mm, yes.
I look forward to seeing just how wrong I am and analyzing where I went wrong. It's probably going to be choosing a bunch of first basemen.
Who would have thought, you know?
So, a bit off topic, but I was scrolling through the Baseball America rankings, and Marquise Grissom Jr. is available to get drafted in this draft, and I just felt extremely old.
Okay, he's our official pick.
I'm sorry.
He is the official draft pick of this podcast.
For you, Thomas, to feel extremely old, it's not good for us.
I turn 26 tomorrow, so I'm on my way down past my prime.
I'm going to be the ignorant one and say, who the hell are we talking about here?
You know, it's funny because I vaguely remember talking about Marquise Grissom in a podcast in the past. Like, he came up somehow tangentially, and I remember you saying, who? Which would be pretty funny.
He played for, like, a long time.
Yeah, in, like, the mid-90s to early 2000s, or
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, he came up in the late
80s. That's like a pretty good player.
Prior to 2005.
Had a few really good seasons.
Well, the Blue Jays are going to draft him, obviously, right? Because they take everyone's kid.
Yeah.
Vlad, Bichette, Biggio.
I mean, worked out well so far.
Yeah, it has.
Yeah. That's the market inefficiency.
Oh, they have Conine's kid too, don't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous.
Well, when you have a good developmental system, you can do stuff like that because, you know, at the very least, they have a pretty good idea from what their dads have taught them. And you maximize it. All right, well, if anybody has any questions or comments or whatever, you can send us an email at our email address from complexthequeens@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at elvlahos343. Ken is at ken1191. And Thomas is at sadmetsseason, S-Z-N. So you could subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcast from. And then, of course, rate and review it. Leave us good reviews, please. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with some more minor league coverage. And until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.